Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be taking a trip back to the Overlook Hotel and talking about Mike Flanagan's Doctor Sleep, which, for those of you who don't know, is a sequel to The Shining. Stephen King put out the book, what, like 8 or 10 years ago? Something like that?
Thereabouts.
Yeah. And predictably enough, somebody eventually made a movie out of it.
And predictably enough, that someone was Mike Flanagan. Because this has really become his bread and butter.
Yeah, this is not his first Stephen King adaptation. He did Gerald's Game for Netflix, which I believe was a novella originally. Stephen King is definitely in Mike Flanagan's wheelhouse for sure.
Yeah, so, he tends to go for the less high-profile Stephen King adaptations, which is to his credit, I think. I don't think the world needs another Pet Sematary, necessarily. But we would not be unreasonable to say that the world also doesn't need a sequel to The Shining, of all things, especially since Flanagan tasked himself with not just adapting the book, but also framing it as a successor to the Stanley Kubrick movie, too. And famously, the Kubrick movie and the King novel have numerous incompatibilities and discrepancies, so that was no small feat, I assume.
Yeah, no, I imagine it was rather a tall order. So just to give the quick rundown, Dr. Sleep primarily follows, I guess I'd say, three characters, really, like two protagonists and an antagonist. We have grown-up Danny Torrance, who's had kind of a rough go of it, spent a lot of years just kind of drifting and drinking. We have a girl named Abra Stone. When we first see her, she's the small child. Then much of the movie, she's a teenager. She also has The Shining, very strong, possibly stronger than Danny's. It's not really clear. And then we have Rose the Hat, who is the antagonist who eats The Shining, basically.
Mm-mm-mm.
Nom, nom, nom. So, Matt, how about you take it away with the synopsis?
Opening scene set in 1980. A girl named Violet goes off picking flowers on a riverbank. She is approached by Rose the Hat, a lady with sort of eerie eyes and a mischievous smile and a top hat who, it reminded me, and I've not read Dr. Sleep, but their exchange reminded me very much of Pennywise encounters, specifically the way that Stephen King writes them in It. Mm-hmm. And the one scene that I liked in the new It movie, which is the one under the bleachers, which I suspect that Stephen King had a hand in writing.
Right.
It's a seduction, basically, you know, don't you want to be friends, that kind of dialogue. And she keeps the kid distracted while a bunch of ne'er-do-wells start to emerge from the trees, and then they all descend upon her in a feeding frenzy.
We then get several scenes of immediately post-Overlook Danny Torrance and his mom. He has clearly not recovered from his experience at the Overlook. He's still seeing the rotting old woman from the bathtub and various other specters, and he's doing his best to drive them away. Thankfully, he has the help of ghost Dick Halloran, who kind of teaches him a trick to ward these specters off, namely by closing them up in boxes. So he does that, and that's kind of how he gets by.
Yeah, it's funny, actually, because one of the biggest divergences in the King movie is that Halloran bites the dust in a big way. He's ex-murder, kill, kill, killed.
Right.
In the lobby of the Overlook. And in the book, he survives. So presumably, again, I haven't read Dr. Sleep, presumably in Dr. Sleep, these conversations are occurring between a very much alive Dick Halloran and a very much alive Danny Torrance. So, you know, thank God these books are about ghosts, because otherwise Flanagan would have really been in a pickle. But it works surprisingly well, him just being sort of a spirit guide kind of figure. So he teaches Danny to trap the ghosts from the Overlook in boxes in his mind, and Danny sort of banishes them to the frozen hedge maze.
Yeah. We jump forward to
2011, I believe.
Yeah, 2011. First, we meet Abra, who, as I said, is a small child at this point. She's having a birthday party, and this is when her parents discover that she's different. Basically, there's this magician at her birthday party doing, like, spoon tricks, and she's like, oh, I can do that too. And he's like, yeah, okay, that's nice, kid. And then her parents are taking the cake inside, and their silverware drawer has been emptied onto the floor.
All but, knives and forks, though, weirdly.
Yes, and then they look up, and all of the spoons are touching the ceiling. And then she walks in and see what I did, basically.
Meanwhile, Danny Torrance is descending into substance abuse, not unlike his father. He's shacked up with this sort of strung-out woman with an infant child.
Shacked up, I think, for the night.
Temporarily,
like,
yes.
Not even, like, a week or whatever, I think. They meet in a bar where he fights this guy, and then they go home together. She appears to have... I just thought she was passed out, having vomited onto the bed, but we find out later that she has actually died, choked on her own vomit, presumably.
He entertains the possibility of stealing money from her wallet, but thinks better of it, mostly because his own personal Jiminy Cricket shows up to chide him in the
Dick,
form of...
Dick says no.
Scatman Crothers. We should all be so lucky.
Yeah, right, exactly. And presumably he also doesn't know that she's dead, because I don't know that he would have left the baby there even in his strung out state if he'd known that the mother was dead.
No, I don't think that bombshell drops for some time.
Yeah, about half hour or so. This is all intercut with Rose and her, I guess I'd call him her chief lieutenant, Crow Daddy, or the Crow, finding this girl named Andy, who has the shining, or as they call it, steam. She's not very steamy, or she's very steamy, etc. And basically she's luring pedophiles and taking their money and marking them with cuts on their face.
And branding their brains, too. Like,
right.
Giving them sort of trigger phrases and basically marking them as pedophiles for life. Really doing them wretched psychologically. She lures one to a movie theater where Casablanca is playing and gives him what she calls a snake bite on his cheek, carves him up, and then walks out and is abducted in the parking lot by Rose and the Crow.
And they take her to meet the rest of the group. Is called the Knot, or the True Knot, I believe. And it's all of the people who were there eating Violet earlier on. And she is turned into one of them by breathing in what little remains of the canister of Violet's steam.
Yeah, they pull out
years ago.
They pull out a soul thermos and start huffing on it as a family.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Danny is drifting, and he drifts his way to this town called Fraser, New Hampshire, I believe. And he kind of stumbles into finding himself a home there. He meets Billy Freeman, who's this kind of, I don't know how to describe him. He's very understanding.
He's a professional sponsor,
think, basically.
Or semi-professional sponsor who can tell that Dan is in dire straits and gets him to sort of clean up his act and start attending AA meetings.
And so the movie proceeds this way for about 15 or 20 minutes. Dan is working as an orderly at this hospice where he sort of helps ease the passing of a variety of elderly and infirm people who know when they're going to die, because there's this resident cat who always sits on their bed when they're about to die, kind of ghoulish.
Mm-hmm.
And
this is how he gets the moniker Dr. Sleep.
Yes.
One of his first patients ascribes it to him. He's trying to console him, saying, you know, maybe it's just like going to sleep. And the guy says, what kind of doctor are you? Dr. Sleep. And they all call him Doc, which is a nice echo of his mother's pet name for him in The Shining.
Yeah, in the flashback sequences, his mom calls him Doc, and Dick even calls him Doc from time to time.
So and there's a scene of them sitting on the couch watching a Bugs Bunny short, in case that was all lost on you.
Right.
Cut to 8 years later, Danny is, or just Dan now, I guess,
yeah,
is delivering a speech at an AA meeting. He's just received his 8-year
sober chip.
And he is talking about how his dad only ever managed 5 months sober, but he feels closer to him. Or growing up, he felt closer to his dad when he drank, but now he feels like they're sharing in this triumphant moment together. It's really good stuff. It's a really well-delivered monologue.
Meanwhile, Abra has been reaching out to him all this time. He has a rather convenient chalkboard wall in his boarding house room, which I figured would be a temporary lodging and ended up being where he stayed this whole 8 years. And so he'll walk into the room and find messages from Abra, and, you know, he'll write messages back.
And crucially, you never see any kind of Harry Potterisms where there's like a floating piece of chalk or
yeah,
something like that. The messages always appear when his back is turned, and he writes in chalk, but she is communicating purely psychically, which kind of gives you a sense of the incongruity there, that she's, especially for someone so young, is really proficient with this stuff,
right,
whereas he's sort of begun to lose touch with it, it seems like, his abilities.
Yeah.
The cadre of steam vampires is running low on their provisions. They're running out of thermos steam, and the crow gets wind of a kid who is just an ace little league player, can practically read the pitcher's mind, seems like, and they abduct him and make short work of him. This is where we first get a sense of what they actually do to their victims. They torture them to death because fear and pain
purify the steam.
Right. And this is also very Pennywise. In the book, the clown talks about how fear salts the meat. So they're not just like dementors. It's not like they just like get right up in your face and go like, and then you're done for. You know, they really like lay into you.
Yeah, they ring out puffs of steam at a time. Abra is... this gets basically broadcast directly into her brain, and so she's waking up screaming in her bed, and her parents come up and console her.
At one point, she tries to contact her imaginary friend, Dan, for help. She does not write in chalk. The chalkboard just partially caves in, and the cracks spell the word murder. Predictably enough, he...
first sees it in a mirror.
Right.
Red rum. So... he's trying to keep his head down in the wake of this, but she wants to find out who this kid was, wants to try and figure out how to find these people that did this and stop them. So eventually, after tracking down the victim, Abra then...
online.
Online through like a national missing child registry of some kind. Then she tracks down Dan while he's working on this, like, tiny train for kids in the town square. She tracks him down there, and they talk. Each finds out that the other one is real and alive.
She tells him that during the murder, one of the murderers for a time was wearing the baseball mitt that belonged to the kid. And she says if they can get their hands on that mitt, she can find out where they are and hunt them down and make them pay. And he sort of wants nothing to do with it. Cue another visit from the scat man,
who tells him to do the right thing and help the girl out.
It's my favorite line in the movie, is when Dan says, "Why me?" And Holleran says, "Why me? You just walked into my kitchen one day and I'm still on the hook." It's a very relatable human moment, especially coming from a ghost. It's yet another instance of the kind of all-seeing, I think it was Spike Lee who dubbed it the magic Negro, you know?
Right.
So it's nice to have a little humanizing moment for a sort of stock archetype like that. That's definitely gotten very, very tired, especially in Stephen King's fiction.
Right. Meanwhile, Abra is having these periodic skirmishes with Rose the Hat, these sort of astral projection battles. Abra tracks down Rose and kind of floats inside of her while Rose is grocery shopping.
Yeah.
And Rose eventually figures this out and tries to push her way in and gets pushed out. This is a shock to her because that's never happened before. She tries to tell Crow Daddy about it and he literally calls bullshit. So this is a big deal for them. And they decide they have to track her down. She'll feed them for years.
Right.
There's another sequence kind of similar to this where Rose tracks down Abra in her house and is about to rifle around in some of her filing cabinet drawers,
which is a leftover idea from Dreamcatcher. I say this having only seen the movie, but that also uses the device of our memories being like libraries.
Abra catches her hand in the filing cabinet and then proceeds to start rifling through Rose's mind instead, which is a little bit more elaborate because, you know, she's older, both visibly and by virtue of the fact that we know she's a ghoul who's been around for a long time.
But not as long as Grandpa Flick?
Yes.
Is that what they called him?
Grandpa
right.
Flick.
So Rose is once again forcibly ejected from Abra's mind, but not before sustaining a lot of damage to her hand. She arrives back on the physical plane just in time to bear witness to the passing of the oldest member of her crew, who dissolves into a puff of steam before her very eyes. And there's a moment of reverence, and then they all just
swallow him up.
Hoover him up, yeah. Yeah. Basically, this underscores the urgency of their plight, that they are running out of food, and he will not be the last one to just keel over and die if they don't get their hands on this motherload of steam that is Abra.
So Abra reaches out to Dan after this encounter, and he decides to dispense with the chalkboard, and they just start doing their telepathy thing, talking to each other in their minds, and he agrees that he's going to help her. First by tracking down the baseball glove and then tracking down the bad guys. And he enlists the help of his friend Billy. He knocks on Billy's door at 4 a.m. and says, "I'm going to tell you a story and you're going to have to try harder than you've ever tried before to believe me." And apparently his friend tries hard enough to go with him. So they drive cross-country to Iowa.
Stephen King loves his long car trips. That's why all his books are so goddamn long. It's because they're always driving from, like, one coast to the heartland. Or, like Pet Sematary. Even the movie just from earlier this year ends with the wife driving all the way back through, like, bumper-to-bumper traffic to yep. just to get promptly killed, like, practically the moment she gets in the door. I don't know what it is, but just... And even Halloran does it in The Shining. Makes a very long journey by car and by plane, and then gets got the second he shows up. It's a sick joke that Stephen King is particularly fond of. Thankfully, no such fate befalls Dan and his sponsor friend when they arrive at the abandoned ethanol plant where the little baseball boy was killed.
Yeah, and there's a pretty good, if maybe a little bit stock, exchange between Dan and Billy when they're getting close, where Billy says,
"If you're crazy, that's bad, but if you're sane, it's worse."
It's worse. Yeah,
right. Exactly. I've heard that exchange a couple dozen times, it feels like, over the years, but this was a well-executed iteration of it.
Yes. So they set about digging the kid up. We get an anecdote from Billy about how he used to be a hunter, and he at one point winged this buck, lost track of him, and then found him 5 days later, and the smell turned him off from hunting forever, and this is the same thing I'm smelling now. And they find the boy's corpse, and they're both retching, and they get the glove, and they get the fuck out, and they drive to go meet Abra. On the way, Dan is telling Abra, "Okay, you're gonna have to let your parents know what's going on, because otherwise Rose will cut through them like nothing. You have to show them." Apparently, she didn't do that, at least not entirely, because when Dan pulls into their driveway, basically Abra's dad storms out into the driveway and treats Dan like he's a pedophile, more or less. Like, "Stay away from my daughter. What do you want? What do you want with her?" etc. And then Abra finishes the job and astral projects the images of the kid's murder into her dad's brain.
Yeah, show don't tell. It's storytelling 101.
and that gets through to him. He has to take a few stiff drinks to calm himself down. Back inside, Abra takes hold of the baseball glove and figures out what the true knot is doing. Meanwhile, the bad guys are making their plans, and Crow Daddy is telling Rose she can't come with them because Abra can track her, because it's been in her mind and they've connected. She can't track the rest of them, so they have to go get her alone, otherwise they'll be seen coming from a mile away. So she reluctantly acquiesces to that logic. Dan and Abra and Billy hatch a plan to lure the true knot out into this park area, this forest area, using Abra as bait, and that's exactly what they do.
Yeah, they think they've got the drop on her. Rattlesnake Andy, the most recent convert, approaches her, and she has this ability wherein she can just tell you what to do
and how to feel,
and you do it. Yeah, right.
They call her a pusher, I believe.
Mm-hmm. And she says, "Oh, we're your friends," so on and so forth, you know, sort of cooing to Abra, and she gets a needle in her neck and tranquilizes her. Says, "That was easy." And then she realizes that she has just plunged a hypodermic into the neck of a fluffy toy bunny rabbit.
At which point, one of the other true knot, I think his name is Barry the Chunk, just starts shouting about parlor tricks.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's fitting just because Abra fancies herself a magician, and the bunny on the picnic table with the needle in its neck harkens back to the bunny coming out of the hat at her birthday party when she was a kid. It's a very, I don't know, there's an element of showmanship to it that I sort of appreciated. Anyway, a bunch of shots ring out. Dan and his buddy are in the brush, and they start picking off the steam vampires.
Yeah, it turns into a very, like, improbable gunfight. Dan and Billy have their deer rifles, and they've got the high ground, and all of the steam vampires have handguns. So it's really, there's a lot of gunfire, and we discover that, in fact, they are vulnerable to bullets, because a bunch of them go down. It's pretty much all of them, with the exception of Snakebite Andy and Crow Daddy, go down.
Who is conspicuously absent.
Right. They all go down in relatively short order.
Yeah, it's a real steam bath. And then Snakebite gets the better of Dan. She tells him to sleep. He resists it for a moment, but his shining just isn't up to snuff. And he passes out. She's about to put a cap in his ass.
Andy wakes him up. Billy comes from around the camper van and shoots her.
Wings her, just like the deer. It's a bad habit of his.
And he gets close to, he hits her again, and then gets close to give her the third and presumably final shot. Danny's shouting, no, no, don't get too close, too late, as she's writhing and doing her sort of shriveled face routine that we've seen from the rest of them. She says, just kill yourself.
Yeah, she gurgles it out, and then he blows his brains out.
And then she dissolves into steam, and it's at this point that we go back to Abra's house and find that Crow Daddy is there and has killed her father and gives her the hypodermic to what is actually her neck and carries her off. So now, once again, she's road tripping, this time with Crow Daddy in the back of a van, drugged and trussed up, and she is trying really hard to contact Dan. The Crow is convinced that she's not going to be able to and tells her as much. Dan, meanwhile, is desperately trying to hear her and turns his mind into a radio. It's a callback to earlier on in the movie.
Yeah, he's trying to shine the way that she does and manages to make contact with her. And then hijacks her body,
right?
Wakes up in the body of a severely tranquilized teenager, and you just hear her go, oh, fuck me. It feels like I'm hungover. I haven't been hungover in 8 years. So then Crow realizes he's not talking to Abra anymore.
Yeah. And they have a fairly entertaining back and forth before the plan is revealed by Dan/Abra saying, you know, if when you expect to live forever, I guess it makes sense that you don't buckle your seatbelt. And then they induce a car crash.
Yeah.
And he goes flying through the windshield and writhes on the ground for a while before dying. And during this whole time,
Rose is privy to all of this.
During the gun battle, and she is in agony. And, like, I think her hair's going a little gray. It's not quite clear whether that's just a lighting thing or whether that was CG they were doing to convey that she's taking battle damage.
Uh-huh.
But that's the vibe I got anyway.
So she recuperates, heals her battle damage by just having a steam free-for-all. I guess now that she doesn't have to share with anybody.
She goes through the rest of her stores.
Yeah, she cracks
all at
open
once,
the
like two or three more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Soul thermoses. Abra walks away from the crash to the nearest motel, I guess, and just kind of huddles outside. And Dan drives out and picks her up. And they
go on another road trip.
They go on another road trip.
This time to Colorado.
Yep, to the old Overlook Hotel, which has been shuttered all this time. And she follows them, because of course she does. Dan tells Abra to wait in the car until I come get you. I don't want you spending any more time in there than you need to. And the reason they've gone to the Overlook is because this place is very dangerous for people like us, and I'm guessing for people like her, maybe even more so. Spoiler alert, that turns out to be the case.
Yeah, I mean, the reasoning is fairly flimsy, but it makes it feel like more of a sequel to The Shining, so I'm basically here for it.
Right.
I mean, it supplies kind of the only climax that feels worthy of The Shining 2.
So Danny goes inside, and he's waking the hotel up. We see him walking through many of the classic interiors, and he sidles up to the bar and meets Lloyd, except this time Lloyd is his dad. It's Jack Torrance, who at first denies that he is Jack Torrance, and eventually,
in exactly the same way that Grady denied ever having been the caretaker,
right,
in the original movie, you know, once the hotels co-opted you, I guess it just sort of puts you in a servile position, but there's an element of trickery to it too. There's a knowing air to their dialogue that the ghost, the entity, whatever it is, knows more than it's letting on.
Right. It also eventually kind of admits, without directly admitting, okay, yeah, that's who I am, because there's this extended sequence about how the whiskey is medicine. When you're a man, there are all of these mouths around you, eating your life and your time, you know, your wife and your kid.
The old sperm bank upstairs.
Exactly. This is basically the culmination of Dan coming to grips with his dad and his relationship with his dad, because he rejects the drink and Jack just kind of disappears. So it's around this time that Rose turns up. Abra alerts Dan and she comes inside. And that's when Dan and Rose meet face to face for the first time. And there's some coy dialogue about how you don't know where you're standing. And then poof. They're in the frozen hedge maze and kind of luring her in deeper and deeper. Abra is doing this kind of like, I'm trying to think what it reminded me of. Oh, it's Gangs of New York.
All right. Yeah, I see it.
Right. Because she keeps running out of the shadows, like slicing into Rose's legs. And it reminded me of Bill the Butcher doing the same thing to Amsterdam Fallon at the end of Gangs of New York. Anyway, that's not super relevant.
No, but I mean, Rose does say around this time, you have the same darkness in you that I recognize myself in you. The only difference between us is time. You don't know what you're capable of because you don't know what you do.
For more time.
Yeah. So I guess the little girl embodying Daniel Day-Lewis in Gangs of New York does speak to that.
Kind of sells that a little bit
that,
more.
To that,
yeah.
that dark quality, for sure.
One second.
Yeah.
It's the middle of November. Just let the grass die. Like what?
We're joined in the studio today by Leatherface. You got anything to say to the people at home?
All right, fuck it, good enough. So
Rose breaks free of this first baited trap.
Yeah, she figures it out just in time to avoid getting closed away in another one of Dan's boxes. And so she sort of advances on him back in the real world. And Abra is sent off to flee into the depths of the hotel. And Rose is giving him the speech, sort of like, we can still work this out. We can join up. You can live well, eat well, live long. Basically the same sales pitch that Andy gets near the beginning of the movie.
And she's selling him on this idea as he's stepping backwards up the staircase where his mother cracked his father over the head with a baseball bat. Except, you know, it's like shot for shot, the exact same. It's just compositionally, it's a total replica of that scene. The key difference is that Danny is wielding an axe. So in this moment, he's assumed the role of his mother, backing up the staircase, but he's wielding his father's weapon. So he's like sort of a synthesis.
Yeah. Well, and there's also
of his parents in a way that I found kind of intriguing.
Yeah. And there's also a shot basically at the climax of this confrontation where he takes the swing with the axe and it looks basically exactly like Nicholson taking the axe to the door.
Sure.
It's framed exactly the same way. So yeah, again, synthesis.
Rose gets the better of him, drives the skinny end of the axe blade into his femoral artery, and so he's bleeding out. She drives her thumb into the wound. She's torturing him.
Getting a little steam.
Yeah, it's getting steamy.
And she's raving about it, even at your age. Incredible.
Yeah, because he's got years and years of trauma and terror locked away in his skull, and she's just on some dumb shit. You know, she's just having a total euphoria moment. It's like the best high that she's had in years and years, and she's hungry for more. And she
finds the boxes.
Yeah, she unwittingly unleashes all of the trapped spirits that Danny's had locked away in the hedge maze in his brain.
Yeah, the line is something like, "What's in these? Something special." And he says, "They're not special. They're starving." Boxes all fly open, and then they're back on the staircase, and all of the ghosts from the Overlook are there.
Yep, all your favorites. You got the two little girls. You got the guy with the bloody seam running down the middle of his face. The great party, isn't it, guy?
Yeah, the lady from the bathtub, etc.
And they make short Grady. work of Rose.
Yeah. Unfortunately, they pretty quickly turn on Dan, too. It's at this point that we cut back to Abra, who encounters first the two little girls and then Dan with like one sort of like cataract eye, which signifies that he's sort of under the spell of the hotel and he's coming after her with the axe. She then ends up in room 237 because we had to go there eventually. And he gets there too. She pushes her way through and brings him back to himself. And, you know, you were supposed to run. She says, I didn't want to leave you here. He says, well, I have to close the door behind us. He's rigged the boiler room to explode, basically.
Which is the original climax of The Shining novel. The hotel explodes at the end. But, all right. So a lot of their dialogue in this scene actually is taken from the original book. Not Dr. Sleep, but from The Shining. But it's between Jack and Danny. Danny is telling his father, this isn't you, this is the hotel. It's just wearing you like a mask. And then the dad says, masks off then. All of this is replicated verbatim in the movie. And it sort of threw me for a loop. And then the boiler explodes. You know, the hotel goes up in flames. Abra makes it out. Danny does not. This is where it diverges from the book a little bit, because in the book, by that point, Jack Torrance is completely enthralled to the spirits of the hotel and is just this gibbering mad person trying to stop the boiler from overheating. Doesn't quite manage it. Whereas here, Dan sort of has this moment of zen where he sits down and sees his mother again and is sort of accepts his fate.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty much it. Like we said, Abra makes it out. Later, she's in her bedroom and she's talking to Danny like Danny talked to Dick, sort of like making peace with her life and what her life's going to be like. And at first she tries to hide it from her mother, and then she tells her mother who she was talking to, and we go on after death, and dad's okay, and we're all going to be okay, and that's it.
Yeah, well, and then the final shot is for her seeing Mrs. 237 in the bathtub of her home and going into the bathroom to put her back in the box.
Which
basically,
we see
very, very nonchalantly.
Yeah, which we see young Danny do during the Bugs Bunny scene early on.
Yeah, so Bustin' makes her feel good. You know, she's gonna she's gonna seal up all the restless spirits, and that'll be that.
So we're gonna go ahead and take our break, and then we'll be back with our thoughts in just a moment.
When I was a kid, there was a place. A dark place. They closed it down and let it rot. But the things that lived there. They come back.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod. Or check us out on iTunes. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
Yes, you run, dear. And then I will find you. And you will scream for years.
Come and play with us forever and ever.
And we're back. Matt, take it away.
I liked this movie a whole lot more than I expected to. I've kind of been down on Mike Flanagan in the past. I haven't been like super vocal about it because I've never flat out disliked any of his movies. They've always just felt... Okay, so I watched Hush for the first time relatively recently, and that's one of his earlier movies. I don't have like an exact timeline in my head.
2016.
Yeah. And it's, there's still a couple of his that I haven't seen. Oculus would be the big one. But I've seen, like, fucking, what, Absentia, Before I Wake. Those are earlier than Hush, come to think of it.
Well, Before I Wake may have been later. I don't, that's the Hard one with the say. Very troubled release history.
Yeah, took forever to, I remember seeing trailers for that movie for what felt like the better part of a decade before it actually got into my eyeballs. I watched all of his Hill House, and there's always just a moment where something happens in all of his movies prior to this one. There's always just a moment where something happened that made me cringe or wince a little bit, and not wince in like a, ooh, that little baseball boy is getting ripped to shreds. Yuck. Like, ah, no, I would not have done it that way.
Right.
Like, you know, the very last line of his Hill House series really, really made my blood boil a little bit. So the reason I brought up Hush specifically, in Hush, the protagonist, the woman who has to fend off a home invader for the better part of 90 minutes, she is an author and she has this problem, blessing and a curse kind of affliction, where she can conceive of dozens of different ways to end a story. She can see all the angles, basically, and it gives her writer's block. She's stymied. But it turns out that this is an asset for her in a survival situation because she can sort of cast her mind forward and visualize all the different ways that this scenario could play out, right? So the moment that this facet of her character was introduced, I was like, okay, there's going to be a moment where Flanagan tries to pull the rug out from under you, and it'll be like a fake out ending, and it'll just be her...
Sketching out an ending.
Yeah, like getting to a bad ending in a choose-your-own-adventure book. I was like, it's going to happen. It's just a question of when. I actually expected it to happen sooner. I thought that he was exercising uncharacteristic restraint until it finally did happen. And I was like, ah, Flanagan, you hack. I knew that was coming. This movie had none of that. It was the first time I really think that, I don't know, this has been such a good year for horror movies, and I had kind of... not low expectations for this one, but maybe, you know...
Managed expectations.
To say the least. And it's honestly, it's right up there with, like, the best horror movies I've seen this year. I don't want to gush about it too much because it's one of those movies where I might cool off on it after a while, given enough time. I mean, we always record these episodes immediately after having watched the movie. But right now, my impression is extremely positive. I think it's Flanagan's masterpiece, or the nearest thing he's made to a masterpiece.
Yeah. The one thing about most of Flanagan's work, and not to tar Flanagan with this particular brush, but I'm going to compare him to James Wan a little bit.
They do have this in common, yes.
Right. In that they go kind of gooey at the end. They go pretty soft, and there's always this kind of the power of love and the power of family sort of thing at the end.
At the end of Before I Wake, the demon is killed with therapy.
Right.
Basically. Just with it's always about a healing journey. This is what I really hated about the end of Hill House, is that it really softens the mansion and the supernatural. It turns it into like Big Fish at the end, basically. And I could not abide that.
Right. And he scratches that itch just a tiny bit at the end of this movie, but it's in a way that is not gooey or unearned or unwelcome. And Matt already touched on it briefly, but it's when Danny is surrounded by the flames, basically, when the boiler's about to explode. and he sees his mother, and then it pans from his mother back to him, except he's a child again. And they just have this moment before it cuts outside and the whole hotel's on fire and Abra's just standing out there.
Well, and the denouement with Abra and her mom is kind of classic Flanagan too, but it doesn't overstay its welcome.
Right.
Where she talks about how dad is okay, there is a life after death.
I guess it's just the biggest thing is that it's earned.
Yeah, very much so. It is actually a welcome reprieve in this case because this movie is at times pretty hardcore. Billy, is that his name? Billy Freeman?
Yeah.
Billy's death is hard to watch. The death of the little leaguer is very hard to watch.
Yeah.
They really emphasize the savagery of this cult that they're up against. There's all this talk. Ghost Jack Nicholson references it at one point, kind of alludes to it obliquely when he says that in a man's life, there are a lot of hungry mouths around you all the time. Dan says over and over again in this movie, the world is a hungry place. The whole movie has a sort of bleak, hostile air to it that really makes you desirous of a little bit of Flanagan gooiness at the end. And then he gives you just a taste, just a little dollop, just enough to send you out the door feeling okay. Right. And it's much more deftly handled than his usual work. And it's really a delight to kind of see him come into his own like this. I say come into his own. It's still very much a Stephen King property, too. And I think that Flanagan and King you can just tell that this guy just devoured truckloads of Stephen King paperbacks when he was in middle school and high school and in his formative years. Because even if Flanagan had never adapted a Stephen King story, his movies would be stamped with a Stephen King sort of sensibility.
Yeah.
Now, whether he was going to ape Kubrick as successfully, that was what I was extremely dubious of going into this movie. I think that he mostly pulls it off. I mean, there's three characters, two we meet right away, and then Jack Nicholson gets saved for the end. But we meet a Shelley Duvall impersonator right up right. front, and there's also an analog for Scatman Crothers. He's especially good. The woman playing Shelley Duvall is also pretty excellent, especially when she's frantically going, "Danny, Danny," when he's like gone missing momentarily.
Yeah.
That she sounds exactly like Shelley it sounds Duvall. Like a soundbite, like an unused take from the original production. It's really spot on.
Yeah.
Jack Nicholson, less so, just because the voice isn't right. You know, you need that kind of drawl that he has.
Reedy.
And it's just not there. And that's...
Well, I agree. But what I will say about it is...
If it had been perfect, it might have been, like, distractingly perfect.
Well, there's that, and also it undershoots it, and I'm glad it did that as opposed to overshooting it.
Yes,
a bad
for
Jack
sure.
Nicholson impression is
And everybody's
is awful.
Got one. I did one earlier when I talked about the sperm bank upstairs.
Right, exactly.
It's one of the easiest impressions to do, but in a cheap, broad kind of way. It's like how everyone has, or at least used to have, an Arnold Schwarzenegger in their back pocket.
Right. So the fact that if they're not going to get it spot on, they err on the side of caution.
And the look is always right. Shelley Duvall or the Shelley Duvall analog is always wearing exactly the right clothes. And that's true of Jack Nicholson, too. He's got the hair over the big forehead that's kind of straggly. And it actually makes him look a little bit like Larry Fessenden at times. Which
just a little bit, yeah.
Was sort of charming. And the fact that it's not actually his father, it's a ghost or a vision or something, sort of
helps paper that over, makes it go
down a little smoother.
And I mean, even though the voice isn't quite right, the rhythms of the speech,
the cadence is right. Yeah.
That's all definitely right. So yeah, I think that all gets carried off reasonably well. I was a little bit suspicious of the Kubrick aping at the beginning of the movie, just because there's an extended reproduction of the tricycle big wheel sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And after that went on for 60 or 90 seconds, I started wondering, okay, like how many of the greatest hits are you going to break out here, Mike?
and he does shut up and play the hits at the end of the movie, but they kind of bookend the movie in a way.
Right.
Which is welcome.
Yeah. Rose gets treated to the blood elevator.
And it seems like it turns her on.
Well,
like she has this kind of inscrutable smirk on her face the whole time she's watching it. That was like, she's such a good villain. That's like a classic Rose the Hat moment.
Yeah, she's like a tourist.
Yeah,
she's an Overlook Hotel tourist.
What struck me during that moment when she was just kind of taking in the sights was that Ewan McGregor, and I don't know the child actress's name, but the two of them look like they're in The Shining. She looks like she's in Ready Player One. She looks, and this was what always bothered me about Ready Player One, specifically about that vignette from Ready Player One, is that Spielberg has, his eye is just as good as Flanagan's when it comes to getting the details right, but tonally, like, the visit to the Overlook Hotel in that movie is all just played for laughs. It's like what Scatman says in the original movie. It's just pictures in a book. It can't hurt you. Now, in The Shining, you don't believe that. In Ready Player One, that's 100% true. It's just ones and zeros. It's just pixels, you know? Yeah. And for her, for Rose, I mean, it is kind of just a lark. I mean, she looks at it as from a distance, like not thinking that it can harm her, which proves to be her undoing.
Yeah.
So that sort of tickled me. I actually saw a kind of amusing article. It might have been the AV Club, like right before Dr. Sleep came out, that said, Dr. Sleep takes you back to the Overlook Hotel for the first time since 2018. And like, I was, and that was my fear going into this, is that I would be like, oh, this is just Ready Player One all over again. Like, it looks exactly right, but it's not imbued with any of the menace of the original film or indeed the original novel. And that's not the case. I mean, it's not like a jump out of your seat scary movie, but it's got an oppressive vibe, and it worked for me.
Yeah.
One thing in terms of like film grammar that Flanagan, that I've not seen him do before, that seems kind of Kubrickian, is he uses dissolves, kind of actually really slow dissolves in this movie a lot more, which feels sort of classic. That harkened back to the editing of The Shining more than anything else that he did. I mean, just getting the composition right is one thing, but the way that you transition from one shot to another is every bit as important, if not more so. And a whole bunch of this movie is strung together with slow dissolves from one image to another in such a way that one kind of lingers even after it feels like it should be off screen, in a way that made me feel sort of uneasy. That was, and you can only credit Flanagan with that, because if I read the credits correctly, he was the sole editor on this too, in addition to having written and directed it. So that was something I was not expecting to see, in sort of the same way that Abra accuses Dan at the end of this movie of just wearing a Dan suit, basically. She accuses the hotel of just impersonating Dan. I was expecting much more of like a taxidermy kind of experience from this movie, where it looked right but it was dead on the inside, and it wasn't. It was very good. I keep tripping over myself trying to convey my surprise at how much I liked it, which I'm gonna endeavor to stop doing, but it really did far exceed my expectations. One thing that I was hoping to see was the man in the dog costume, costume, whatever you want to call
damn.
It
damn.
How yeah. is that not one of your rogues gallery?
That's a mystery.
Yeah, well, it's just, and I know that it's a moment that's easy to make fun of in the original, but it is also incredibly alarming the first time you see it.
Yeah.
A man in a bear suit giving a dapper gentleman a blowjob. As much as I like Dr. Sleep, it doesn't have that element of Kubrick weirdness to it. You know what I like? It doesn't hit you with a curveball like that. There's something kind of comfortingly familiar about it. I mean, it brings new elements into play that I assume are all from the book. I mean, I really like, there's nothing about The Shining. Who is the fucking like Bram Stoker's great nephew or something, like who wrote the official
Doc Ray Stoker,
the official sequel to Dracula, like within the past 10 or so years?
Yeah.
You know, like that, it's not, it doesn't,
I bought that for $5 at Barnes and Noble.
I know you did. It's the only reason I know it exists. If someone had done that, or like there's like unofficial sequels to The Godfather that give me kind of the same energy. If someone had done that, but for The Shining, that book would not have been about a bunch of hippie steam vampires.
No.
Going around like that. There is a lot of new material here, and I assume it all comes from Stephen King. So it's not like the movie is completely without surprises, but when it comes to the Overlook business, it plays it a little safe. And that didn't bother me on this viewing. It might bother me on subsequent viewings. Only time will tell.
Yeah.
On the subject of those hippie steam vampires, I really like their whole scene. I mean, I just they reminded me of the vampire cowboys from Near Dark.
I was just gonna say,
by way of the Mansonite murderers from like Last House on the Left. They're a scary bunch, but they're also a family, and which is, you know, sort of a Manson thing, you know.
Yeah.
But they're close knit or knotted in a way that makes them. I don't know. It's funny. I was expecting a redemption arc for Andy, for the one who's sort of perpetually 15.
Yeah, she's the most recent convert. Yeah,
I liked that she dies cackling after having forced a man to kill himself, because it's not what I was expecting.
Yeah,
and
there's no redemption there.
Yeah, no. And it's the kind of, again, I assume it's from the book, but it's the kind of sleight of hand that you don't, or that I haven't really gotten from Flanagan's work all that often. The revelation of the identity of the broken neck lady in Hill House, which I shan't spoil, was one moment where it's like, ooh, you got me.
Yeah.
But his oeuvre, it doesn't have that many sucker punches in it, and that was one for me. So I think it's something that he's getting better at as he matures.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. I hope that Mike Flanagan continues to keep putting out movies and get better, because somebody needs to take away the mantle of America's leading horror filmmaker away from James Wan, for Christ's sake.
I mean, if nothing else, Flanagan is a fucking workhorse. I mean, he's made exclusively horror movies, to my knowledge.
Yeah.
And he comes out with like one every other year, seems like. It's gradually, even if they're hit or miss, if you keep up these numbers, the batting average is not bad.
Well, right. It's like Sidney Lumet put out like a movie basically every year for 50 years. And
if one of them happens to be A Stranger Among Us, that's fine. That's the one that's Witness, except instead of Harrison Ford, it's Melanie Griffith, and instead of the Amish, it's Hasidic Jews.
So
nothing to write home about.
Yeah, or like Family Business, where Sean Connery, Dustin Hoffman, and Matthew Broderick are like three generations of a criminal family.
That sounds fucking fascinating. I've never even heard of that.
It's not nearly as good as it ought to be.
I mean, if nothing else, that sounds like a heartbreaking volume of wasted potential.
Yeah. So
anyway, we didn't plan to have a very belated roast of Sidney Lumet in this episode, but your point is well taken.
Yeah, you have a couple of those. Even if like over half of those are your filmography, you've also got your 12 Angry Men and your
Serpico.
Fucking
Prince of the City is really good. I love The Verdict. It's like one of my all-time favorites.
Yeah. So
Before the Devil Knows You're Dead is outstanding.
Yeah, and that was his last.
Yeah,
so
swan song.
Went out on a high note. So yeah, and I completely agree that Mike Flanagan, up to this point, is often rather gooey and telegraphs a lot of things that are theoretically supposed to be twists and so forth. But I think, I'm not going to say he's put out a better average of great movies than Sidney Lumet has, far from it. That's a crazy fucking thing to say. But like, relative to his own standard, he's been more hit than miss.
Yeah, and we've come a long way since The Canker Man.
You're right. The Canker Man.
Before I Wake is not even a bad movie. I mean, no. I set up right after the break, he's never made a movie that I straight up disliked. I just find his movies kind of toothless a lot of the time, but not so this time around. And I liked Gerald's Game a lot, too.
Yeah. I suppose now's the time to check the box of the performances were all pretty good.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Ewan McGregor's really good.
Yeah, I singled out that monologue, that AA 8 years sober monologue for praise earlier, but he's good from start to finish. There's one moment that sort of gave me goosebumps where it's his last scene with Dick Halloran. Ewan is smiling ear to ear. I can't remember what about. Oh, he's talking about having busted the last ghost from the Overlook. He's talking about how he got the better of him, and he's grinning. And for a second, like seen in profile, the big toothy grin. He looks exactly like Jack Nicholson. it's like it's his dad's smile. And I don't know if Ewan like worked on that specifically, or if he was coached to smile exactly that way, because he did, because he Lloyd or whoever behind the counter is not doing a spot on Jack Nicholson impersonation, but it comes out in little ways in unpredictable moments. And that was the one that kind of really sealed the deal for me. Like, oh, this guy's done his homework.
Right. Matt talked about what a great villain Rose the Hat is, and in keeping with having a great villain, you have a great villain performance from Rebecca Ferguson, who's, I mean, she's really good.
Yeah, her Irish brogue is inconsistent, to say the least, but that sort of worked for me because she's been alive for so long. It sort of feels like it might be the kind of affect that would drop in or out depending on, I don't know,
her intent.
On,
yeah.
Yeah, right. Depending on any number of variables.
Like at the very beginning when they trap the little girl, Violet.
She's extremely hoity-toity-toity.
She's profoundly Irish and it's solid all the way through. And that's it's presumably to help sell, like, hey, I'm non-threatening. Please be my friend.
Yeah, and
so
I can eat you. And it gives her an aura of, like she's going to take her to go play with the fairies. It makes her feel like a more approachable sort of fairy tale nursery rhyme kind of character. I'm Rose the Hat, you know, that sort of thing.
Right, exactly.
They're after me Lucky Charms.
But yeah, she's very good. The actress who plays Abra is very good. If we were worth our salt, we probably would have looked up her name, and we didn't, so oops. The rogues gallery of the True Knot, they're all pretty good. I mean, there's a few of them who do most of the talking, and the rest of them are just kind of, like, decorative.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones that do have more of a character, whether little snippets of Barry the Chunk, he's pretty good. He played the caretaker in the Hill House show.
Oh, yeah. I thought I knew him from somewhere.
Yeah. And as we said, there's Snakebite Andy, and she's rather good.
And I just like, they've just got fun names, Chunk and Crow Daddy and Snakebite. I mean, that to me makes it feel, it's very Wes Craven. I mean, I already talked about Last House on the Left, but they're also got kind of a Hills Have Eyes energy to them. I mean, they're more domesticated than that, but it feels, I don't know, they're almost like there were some scenes of the Knot clan just camping out where I was struck by the odd sensation of watching a version of Devil's Rejects that I liked.
In case we haven't made it clear, that's as opposed to the actual version that exists.
Yeah, which is better than House of a Thousand Corpses,
which
is about the best thing I can say about it.
Which isn't much.
And another, you know, I guess you can add Rob Zombie to the list of horror auteurs who I kind of hope that Flanagan dethrones sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I'm with you there.
If he hasn't already, because I don't.
Rob Zombie's been doing this thing where, like, I'm going to put out a movie and then we're going to release it in theaters for 3 days. It's like, okay, you think you're going to make a bundle in those 3 days?
Well, fuck us, I guess, because Dr. Sleep isn't making money either.
Well, sure. But, yeah, okay. I mean, I'll readily grant you that, but it's like, I guess Rob Zombie, on the basis of the critical reception of his more recent films, is neither making money nor making films that are any good. Whereas, although critical reception on Dr. Sleep has been a little bit more mixed than our feelings about it, it's at least relatively well-received, even if it's not making a ton of money.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it deserves to be performing certainly much better at the box office than it has, but also, I'm with you, I think that it deserves slightly more love from the Tomatometer, too, which is my obnoxious name for the tomato meter.
Or the whatever you call the Metacritic score.
Yeah, I don't think I've concocted a... Yeah,
I don't think anybody has a name for that except Metacritic score.
Yeah, it's a damn shame that Dr. Sleep is losing money, because not just underperforming, but like operating at a loss, last I checked.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's possible that people just didn't care, because I think marketing it as a sequel to The Shining was savvy. But, you know, at the end of the day, the name recognition just isn't there. I'm glad that it wasn't called The Shining 2, Return right. to The Shining or whatever.
Right.
But Dr. Sleep is not one of those classic Stephen King properties. It's not like another Pet Cemetery or another It,
right.
for example. And I also think that the new It might have turned some people off of especially 2 hour and 40 minute long Stephen King movies for a little while. I mean, that movie made a lot of money, but if people felt burnt by it, as I surely did.
Well, and it also didn't make nearly as much as the first one did.
Right.
So Yeah,
so it's possible that that poisoned the well a little bit. I'm not trying to, we're the shock doctors here. We're not like market experts or anything, but
it's a theory that I think holds water, though.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, I mean, Dr. Sleep is a hefty 152 minutes. It's shorter than It Chapter 2, but not by a ton. Certainly clips along a lot faster, which was welcome.
Mm-hmm. On the subject of It, because I still have grievances to air with that movie, the second one, I mean, there was a moment in this movie where Flanagan, I said in our review of It Chapter 2 that any Stephen King adaptation has to risk looking ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has to have that courage, and it has to do some kind of wacky high wire stunt without a net at least one critical juncture. Or to me, it doesn't feel like a proper, like it's true to the spirit of Stephen King, because his books are so whacked out and out there at times. It especially, the ending of It especially. And there was a moment in Dr. Sleep where there's a shot of Rose the Hat cartwheeling through the sky that looked fucking preposterous, but yep, in a way that I really found myself embracing, just because we talked also in that It review. I went on a little rant about how, oh, people say that such and such book is unfilmable. That's not true. You can film it. It just might look a little silly. Her ragdolling through the clouds, this is when she's being kicked out of the little girl's mental filing cabinet. Her spinning through the stratosphere like that, I thought, yes, yes, yes. The climax of It Chapter 2 should have had more of this in it. As silly as it looks, like this is what Chud should have looked like. You know, like psychic battle. Just swing for the bleachers, man. The ending of It Chapter 2 just felt like Killer Clowns from Outer Space to me. It had all the gravitas of like them just fighting a weird alien clown with his dumb praying mantis body. I think Flanagan gets it in a way that Andy Muschietti and Gary Dauberman just didn't. And even when the execution is a little slapdash, I think Flanagan still is in touch with what actually makes Stephen King novels so engrossing, which is, and what makes them such page turners, that you genuinely
don't know what the fuck is about to happen.
Yeah, you don't know what to expect. He could hit you with some crazy bullshit any minute now. We don't talk about music a whole lot here on the Shock Doctors podcast, because so many of the movies we see just have perfunctory jump scares in them. Just kind of a parade of scare chords from beginning to end. This movie, I talked before about how the dissolves, how Flanagan's use of dissolves felt very classically Kubrick and very true to the original The Shining. The music is also exactly right, which is to say that it's not note for note, beat for beat, just reusing samples from the original. It evokes the music in the original movie, but puts its own spin on it. It's got a lot of the like ting, 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 the kind of Native American instrumentation almost. What I love about the score in the original Shining is that most of the time it's hard to even say what instruments you're listening to. Like when, fuck me, what does he say? When Jack Nicholson emerges from behind Shelley Duvall when she's reading his manuscript. Oh, and he says, "How do you like it?" The like skittering, plunking, like it sounds like stringed instruments, but more than anything, it just sounds like a bunch of spiders in a jar. You know, it's just otherworldly, and this movie has a lot of that in it, that kind of alien instrumentation, which really won me over even before the visuals did. I thought, oh, this movie just sounds exactly the way I want it to sound. You know, I could close my eyes and I'd still know that I was watching a sequel to The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
That was on point.
Yeah. And there's also occasional dollops of the Overlook Hotel theme.
Bom, 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 bom. Yeah.
Bom, 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 bom. Yeah. Sorry, I made it sound a little too Inception-y, but it's good.
And that's a classical composition, the name of which escapes me right now, so we both look like a pair of rubes, but it's... you know, Kubrick only made book adaptations, and a lot of his music was also borrowed or lifted wholesale from classical music. It's not just, I mean, that's obviously the case in Clockwork Orange, but he did it left, right, and center all the way up to Eyes Wide Shut. But I always think of it as the Shining music,
because
that movie just looms large over my whole life. Pretty sure it was my first Stanley Kubrick movie. Might have been my first, like, big boy grown-up horror movie. Actually, I watched it when I was really young.
Yeah, I think it was my first Kubrick film. I don't know about horror movie. Probably not. But, yeah, and I mean, in the same way, and obviously this is a less critically well-regarded example, but the theme to Super Mario Brothers was not written for Super Mario Brothers. It's borrowed from some kind of classical composition also. Not a lot of people know that.
I didn't know that, yeah, actually.
Well, learn something new every day.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a thing that is done, and sometimes compositions that predate very famous pieces of pop culture then become inextricably linked to them. It's just how
the,
it is.
The Entertainer and The Sting is another
unforgettable
example.
Precisely.
The one thing I will say on the subject of the original The Shining and it being as perfect a movie as has ever been made to my eyes. No movie is perfect. I mean, The Shining is always going to have that shot in the opening scene during the credits where for a moment in the bottom right corner, you can glimpse the shadow of the helicopter that's filming all of this. Even Stanley Kubrick didn't make flawless movies. And if he can't do it, nobody ever has, because he's a legendary perfectionist.
Right.
It's like the thing that he's known for.
Yes.
So that makes it easier for me to look past the things about Dr. Sleep that didn't quite gel for me, chief among them being I think it might have been a mistake to reuse the climax from the original Stephen King book, The Shining, that is to say, because it feels like he is throwing the fans a bone, and maybe also throwing Stephen King a bone, because Stephen King
was grumpy about the original Kubrick film.
Yeah.
And how freely adapted it was.
It's probably the most famous case of an author taking umbrage with a movie adaptation. I mean, I'm hard-pressed to think of. It would be like if Harper Lee hated the Gregory Peck To Kill a Mockingbird. It would like that caliber of high-profile adaptation that the author was really sour on.
Yeah.
And so I feel like Flanagan is trying to serve two masters a little bit right at the very end of this movie, and it was the only moment where the movie lost me a little bit, specifically the business with the boiler exploding. That works in the book beautifully because the boiler is introduced in the very first chapter. Jack is being given a tour of the hotel by Ullman, and Ullman is kind of a snotty dickhead, even more so than he is in the Kubrick movie, and he's talking to him about how you have to make sure that the meter doesn't get above a certain level or the whole hotel is going to be reduced to cinders, basically. And so it's a Chekhov's gun that runs all the way through the book. And near the end of the book, when all the shit is hitting the fan and Jack is going on a rampage, you have forgotten about the boiler just like he has. And you've had a whole book to forget about it. And when he realizes his mistake, there's this oh shit moment where you kind of share his panic as he runs into the basement to try to save the hotel that he is now completely at the beck and call of. In the movie, maybe 15 minutes elapses between Ewan McGregor firing up the boiler and the hotel exploding. And so it's just not the same. And I don't know how it could have been, but I said before, it feels like Flanagan is throwing fans of the book a bone, but if in a way, for me, if you have read the book, you also see the ways in which this development comes up a little short or is not what it could have been. So that, if this movie isn't like a masterpiece, then for me, that's why, just because it stumbles ever so slightly right at the finish line, and not in the way that Flanagan movies usually stumble, so kudos for that. But again, no movie is perfect. The original Shining is, much as it pains me to admit it, technically not perfect because of that fucking shadow. And so I can make peace with that. It's also, Dr. Sleep is a much more leisurely movie than the original Shining. I mean, they're about the same length. They're both horror epics. But The Shining, that setting, the Overlook Hotel, is just airtight. You know that it's going to be a cabin fever story. that is going to play out over a period of weeks or at most a few months, because their tenure at the hotel is only supposed to last for the winter season.
Yeah.
You know, whereas Dr. Sleep plays out over a period of years. It's a little bit more of a Shaggy Dog story, and that might bother me more the more I go back and watch it. But how many, I feel like I've said this on the podcast before, how many movies am I really compelled to go back and watch? Not many. Yeah. So the fact that I'm even thinking about it in those terms means that I really, really enjoyed it. And
yeah.
That's as good a note as any to end on, I guess. It's good stuff.
Agreed.
Good shit.
Well, as always, this has been another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And all work and no play makes Matt and Jim dull boys. We will see you next time.
How'd you like it?
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Stephen King's Dr. Sleep Final Trailer HD, uploaded by Warner Brothers Pictures. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, December 15th, and we'll be dipping our toes back into the horror schlock pool with the killer app film, Countdown. See you then.